Thank you. The call is now being recorded. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone on today's Locking Working Group call on Thursday, the 26th of April. We have Matt Schneller, André Pizyuk, Volker Greimann, Randy Ferguson, Gabriela Slack, John Berryhill, Faisal Shah, David Maher, Lisa Garono, Victoria McEvdy, Brian Beckham. From staff, we have Margie Milam, Marika Konings, and myself, Gisela Gruber. Apologies noted today from Joy Lidicott, Ken Stups, and Michele Nalon. Michele may be able to join us later, but if he doesn't, he has sent through his apology. If I could also please remind everyone to state their names when speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you. Over to you, Marika.
Thank you very much, Gisela. This is Marika. As you might have seen, Michele had a last-minute conflict and has actually asked if I could manage the call until he gets on, if he's able to join today. So unless there are any objections or anyone else willing to volunteer to take that job, you know, I'm happy to do so. So on the screen, I just put as a reminder an update of the membership list. We had one new person joining in between the last call and this week's calls, which is Sherry Falco from the Registry Stakeholder Group. She only just joined today, and I did send her the call details, but I don't think she's on the call, and it might be difficult for her to join on such last-minute notice. As you can see as well, we do have statements of interest of almost all participants. There are still two missing, so if I can just remind those people to please complete them. And if you have any updates to your statement of interest, you know, please raise your hand and say so now and or make updates to the statement of interest as required. So if there are no further issues on the statements of interest and the memberships, we'll move to the item number two on the agenda, which is whether there are any further questions in relation to last week's meeting and then the recommended materials for review. There was quite a bit of information that we shared on last week's call, including the working group charter, information on how a PDP works, the working group guidelines, some of the background information that led up to the creation of this working group. And I hope everyone had a chance, an opportunity to review that materials, and would just like to ask if there are any questions that people would like to ask at this stage, or if you still need a bit more time to review that, please feel free as well to circulate any questions you may have on the mailing list, or send them to me directly, whatever you prefer. So are there any questions? I don't see any hands being raised. Then with regards to item three, I would suggest that we wait there until Michele makes it to the call, as he's currently acting as the interim chair, and that we move that item to the end of the meeting agenda. In case Michele doesn't make it, that will be then the first item for next week's meeting, because we still do have a need to formalize the leadership for this working group. And as also said on the email, yesterday, if there are any volunteers, please feel free either to speak up now or when we get to the item later today, or send your interest to the mailing list. If people have questions as well about what it requires to be a chair or be a vice chair or a co-chair, I'm also happy to provide more explanation about that. And there's also further information available on what that role entails in the working group guidelines. So if we then skip to item number four, that's the development of the work plan. It's one of the required elements of a working group. The working group is expected to develop a work plan and submit that to the GNSO Council for its information. And I'm just pulling up. As you may have seen in the email I sent, the agenda yesterday, I attached a template which the working group might consider using as a basis for developing this work plan. And what I've done, as you can see here in the first text bit, I've outlined the required elements that the working group needs to consider as it completes its work plan, notably the elements that are required as part of its charter, but also the elements that are required as part of the policy development process and the different products the working group needs to produce and related comment periods that are linked to that. So that in a way defines how the time or how the work plan is built. This item clearly links as well to the next item, you know, how to tackle the different items in the working group's charter, because that will probably define as well, of course, how much time needs to be spent on different items. But I think on a high level, what we might want to do now is talk a little bit about the broad timing the working group would like to set itself to achieve certain outcomes. And I think, you know, one of the big milestones is often the publication of an initial report, and it often helps if the working group sets itself a certain time frame or target for publishing such a report. It helps as well to fill in the other elements of the work plan. So what you can see on the work plan, I've basically filled in based on assuming that there are going to be weekly meetings of this group, and I filled it in up to the ICANN meeting in Toronto, assuming that probably the working group will have to continue beyond that unless we start working on a really tight schedule and are able to complete in a 6-month time frame, which is probably unlikely based on experience of previous working groups. But for example, the working group might want to consider setting the Toronto meeting as a target to publishing the initial report, for example. Throughout here, you see as well a couple of highlighting the different ICANN meetings. As some of you may be aware, if there are certain documents that are to be discussed at an ICANN meeting or where community input is requested, there are certain publication deadlines that are linked to that the working group might need to take into account if it is planning to present certain documents at an ICANN meeting. So with that, I would actually like to open it up to the working group and get people's input on what they think are, you know, reasonable target dates and maybe get as well some ideas on how much time people think is required for the different steps of the process. You know, we're looking first at requesting public input. There needs to be a request for stakeholder group constituency statements. Groups need to foresee as well, you know, deliberating on the different charter questions. And then, of course, as well, you know, developing and publishing the initial report. Are there any comments or suggestions, ideas? I'm not sure whether everyone is already awake. Laurie, please go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I think that getting the public input first would be probably the best approach so that we know, you know, what kind of comments we're going to receive.
Yes, thank you, Laurie. I think it's a very good point. And Matt?
Yeah, just sort of building on that, all I was going to say is that particularly getting comments from the registrar community to see what the standard practice is, I think will be really useful in helping us with all the definitional and other problems that we have, just knowing what the standard practice is across the industry.
Okay, good point.
By the way, is that a 35-day timeline for the is the constituency statements request different than the public comment forum, or can those run simultaneously, or how do those interrelate? They seem like they could have a lot of overlap.
Yeah, this is Marika. That really depends on the working group. I mean, nothing prevents stakeholder groups or constituencies to also submit comments to a public comment forum. But as part of the PDP, the working group is also required to specifically reach out to stakeholder groups and constituencies to request their input in the form of statements. What other working groups have done, for example, to really get, you know, specific input is prepare a template with certain questions. So, and for example, those might differ as well. As you know, you mentioned that you know, it might be helpful to get specific input from the registrar stakeholder group. So you might want to prepare, you know, specific questions that are then sent for the registrar stakeholder group to consider as part of their statements. So that's something the working group can consider, how they would like to go about that, whether indeed they just say, look, this working group has gotten started, you know, we want your input, or whether you really want to tailor those questions, which probably will help you to get more specific information and might be more helpful in what you're trying to achieve. The only requirement there is, as it says there, it needs to be a minimum of 35 days to give them enough time you know, to consult with their membership. But again, that can be done in parallel to the public comment forum. It can be done before the public comment forum. You know, it can be done afterwards. So that's really up to the working group how you would like to set the different different activities and the according timelines.
Hi, Marika.
David?
Yeah, just David Rush Turner from WIPO, also here with Brian. Listen, just one comment on that suggestion that maybe some comments could be sent around, some questions. One of the questions that could perhaps usefully be included in those might be, particularly from the registrar perspective, and we spoke about this a bit in the last discussion, the extent to which the existing draft registrar best practices document that I think John Berryhill sent around in an email might usefully provide a foundation for further discussion. Because there was a lot of thinking and work invested in that at the time, and if that's something that that many in the registrar constituency would already be comfortable with, that might save us all some time in further deliberations.
I would agree with that, David.
Thank David for that suggestion. I do have a question or maybe a comment there, because I did listen to the recording, and I've you know asked internally as well to see what the you know, where that draft is that was discussed in Sydney, because the only thing I could find publicly was a version from 2008. But looking at the version in 2008 and also the discussion in Sydney, it does look like that paper was much broader than just the locking issue. So I don't know, John, as you are, I think, involved in that discussion and then drafting, you know, I don't want to put you on the spot, but do you have any insight into, you know, whether the whole paper or just part of that paper might be, you know, relevant as we're specifically focusing on the locking aspects, or what is your view on that?
I've been meaning to go back and just tease out the locking portion of it, we may find that having a registrar place and or remove a lock may assume actions taken by other parties, but I think the locking part can come out. We tried to solve a couple of problems beyond just locking in that document in terms of additionally getting information to the registrar initially with the complaint in the event of a transfer, so that, you know, the registrar is informed of the authorized party for receiving a transfer at the end if there is one. But I think that the locking part can be teased out, yes.
Okay. Maybe with that, then I would suggest that we actually move into item 5, because I think, you know, discussing the approach and you know, getting an understanding of how the working group would like to go about these different items, and I think we, you know, partly already started that discussion, you know, talking about the work plan, I think will help us as well, you know, completing the work plan. I mean, there's no specific deadline for that, and again, I think, you know, the work plan is most of the time stays in a kind of draft form, and working groups regularly go back to it to update it, but it's merely for the students or council to have an idea of the different milestones that the working group has set itself, and being able to check from time to time as well where things stand. And it's also a tool for the working group to, you know, make sure that you're on track with what you've set yourself out to do. So if we move then into item 5 of the discussion, what I've done, and some of you might be familiar with the mind maps which have been used for some of the other working groups we've been recently doing. I've started working on a mind map and trying to outline the different elements that the working group needs to address. There are sort of different parts to this. I hope you can see it on the screen. So the first part is looking at outreach, then really strata questions, and then looking as well at the requirements for the initial report. The idea about this mind map is that it allows for the working group now to have a kind of free-flowing discussion or brainstorm on these different items, what, you know, you think should be considered or should be done, so that we can then use this as a tool as well to, you know, pull us into the work plan and really be able to outline, you know, for each part, you know, what the working group would like to do and how to approach it. So if you look at the outreach element here, I think these are the three things that require the working group actively going out and requesting input. And the first item there is requesting public input on the issue, and that's what directly comes from the charter. In order to have a clear understanding of the exact nature and scope of issues encountered with the locking of a domain name subject to UDRP proceedings. So I can already create a subtopic here, and basically saying, because I think I heard already some people saying, well, we should specifically ask questions to the registrar stakeholder group. We said as well, looking at the best practices paper. I don't know if that's something that might want to need to precede this part, this step. What I suggest as well, I mean, the different ways of looking at getting public input. I mean, there's you can do a public comment forum, reaching out to experts. There's also the possibility of, for example, organizing a workshop or a session in Prague to obtain input. So I think there are various avenues the working group could explore here. David or Brian, I don't know who wants to speak.
We answered our own question. Thank you.
Okay. So what are the ideas or suggestions the working group has for requesting input? What do you think are the most effective ways, or what is really needed in order for the working group to get the information it needs to start looking at the charter questions?
Just as a preliminary question, Marika, as I understand it from the agenda, we will be discussing the charter questions after we've developed the work plan, correct?
That's probably the best, I don't know if it's the best approach, but I think it's a way of making sure that there's a structured approach to addressing the charter questions. So the idea is to first, in this mind map, try to maybe outline for each of the charter questions what is needed in order to start the discussions, or making sure as well that maybe some of the questions that need to be asked in relation to the charter questions are addressed. And then at the point we get there, then we actually start the deliberation. So the idea is indeed here first to try to establish an approach and maybe determine as well, is there a certain order in which the charter questions should be tackled? Or are there questions missing or sub-questions that can be identified that might help the working group get to answers on each of these items?
Well, one possible sub, I'm not sure if this is the right time, but just to mention, one possible sub-question which might be included in connection with number three of the charter questions is also one of the subjects which was addressed in the best practices discussion as a subset of that. And there's I think as the charter question three currently reads, it's whether the timeframe by which a registrar must lock a domain name after a UDRP has been filed should be standardised. And I suppose one suggestion that we would have for that is whether that should be slightly refined to also include a reference to, in addition to, has been filed and or a provider request is received, because, of course, while in every UDRP proceeding a complaint is filed, equally, certainly in every WIPO UDRP proceeding, a registrar request would be sent to the relevant registrar to lock. So that might be a useful clarification in that particular charter question.
Okay, thanks. I've noted that here, so that's something that the working group can debate further.
Thanks.
Matt, please go ahead.
Sure, I was going to ask if there's a way to sort of request targeted input from third parties that aren't necessarily pre-existing stakeholder groups. I was thinking in addition to the registrars, it may be useful to get some preliminary input from the UDRP service providers. We obviously have two guys from WIPO on the call, but also the Czech Arbitration Forum, the National Arbitration Forum. And they may have some internal tracking stats as well that might be useful to bring into this discussion. But I didn't know if we sort of had to get in, like what the mechanism was to get input from folks who aren't formally part of one of the defined communities.
Matt, just to answer that question briefly from WIPO's perspective, we're certainly very happy to feed whatever data we have into this process directly. We can do that in whatever way is most useful for the working group in phone calls or in documents. We have some stats that we can put together. No problem. I think we represent about 56-odd% of the cases. So I think that should give a pretty clear representative indication as to how the providers go about it. I'm not sure what the answer to that would be. I guess Marika may know more.
And this is Marika. I think what was done, for example, in the review of the UDRP discussion was, for example, send out a survey to the different service providers and asking them your specific questions, and that was the way that input was received. And I think they also organized a workshop at one of the ICANN meetings where there was a panel session where, as well, different parties participated, you know, through a moderator, you know, trying to tease out some of the information that, you know, was helpful in that discussion. So there I think, again, then, you know, it's really up to the working group, and there's a lot of flexibility on how to do that. It, you know, it probably depends as well what is deemed the most effective. And, you know, for example, organizing a session at an ICANN meeting only works if you know, certain parties are present there. So I guess, you know, presumably in Prague, you might have, you know, someone from the Czech forum there, and you know, I guess WIPO will be represented, but, you know, it might be as well a way to reach out to some of the others to see if they're actually going to be present and if it makes sense to have a discussion there, for example. Are there any other ideas or suggestions on how to go about the outreach element? Do people think, for example, and obvious one is opening a public comment forum. Do people think it's sufficient to just, you know, put out the charter questions, or do people think that, you know, there might be more useful input obtained if specific questions are being asked, or if that's done as well in the form of a survey? What are people's views?
I would tend to think that it's an issue that is of interest to people, you know, who are affected by it. So it may be that a call for public comments would be one of the more useful options, in the sense that you're putting it out there for those people who want to be involved to comment and see what we get back.
And this is Marika. I mean, and I think the public comment forum is a good complement as well to any other activities that the working group might want to undertake. So I think, looking concretely, you know, one of the pressing issues is that in order to organize a session in Prague, there is an internal deadline that staff has to request a meeting by Thursday of next week. You know, my suggestion to the working group would be that, you know, I do request a slot for the working group, and that, you know, closer to the date, the working group can define and whether indeed the meeting is needed, whether it's, you know, should take the form of an internal working group session, whether it should be a workshop, whether it should be, you know, another kind of meeting, and you know, define it closer to the date. But at least in that way, there, you know, there will be a slot available should the working group decide to have a meeting there. Anyone that objects to that approach, I think the idea would be then to request a time for Thursday morning, which is it's either Wednesday or Thursday morning that are usually the slots for workshops and working group meetings. Then maybe looking at some of the other items here that are on the mind map, you know, we also need to seek the opinion of other ICANN ACs and SOs. Are there any ideas? Are there, in your view, any specific supporting organizations or advisory committees that might have an interest in this issue that we should approach, or should this be done as well, just sending them a link, for example, to the public comment forum? Do people have any ideas on whether we need to do anything specific there, whether any other parts of the ICANN organization that might have a view on this or would like to contribute to this discussion? I don't see any hands. Maybe people want to talk and then about how to approach the different charter questions. Laurie, please go ahead.
sorry, I was on mute. I just wondered if we should perhaps ask the registries for their input, because they sometimes receive UDRP decisions as well if the registrars won't cooperate.
Thanks, Laurie. I've noted that in the requesting the public input, and I think there, you know, the working group might start thinking a bit, you know, what are the kind of questions you would like to put forward, because I think it would be helpful there. Some people need to start working on either a kind of questionnaire or survey or whatever the working group thinks is most useful to get that kind of input. So maybe people already can start thinking about, you know, some of the questions that that would need to be put forward to the registrars as well as the registries.
One of the potential questions there could be where you have a transfer in breach, either of paragraph 8A or 8B of the UDRP, where, or particularly 8B, where the disputed domain name moves from one registrar to another, whether there should be a procedure for either returning the domain name to the original registrar or a mechanism which describes what the gaining registrar should then do in respect of its lock obligations and notifying the UDRP parties, et cetera, so any necessary amendment of pleadings can occur. And perhaps also what the registry's role in that sort of situation might be when the registrars are unable to sort the matter out with the provider or panel directly or parties.
Thanks. Was that David?
Yeah. Sorry, Marika. David.
Sorry. Just make sure we got it right. So, yeah, David, that sounds really good. So, you know, if you maybe would be willing to you know, put those questions already, you know, either on the email so people can start thinking about as well additional questions to that, but I think that would be really helpful. So if you would be so kind to put that in an email, I think that would be really helpful.
Sure.
So if there are no further, you know, comments or suggestions on the outreach part, I think we have now, you know, specifically asking the registrar and the registry stakeholder group for input, probably using specific questions. I think there then we need to consider are, you know, the questions different for the registrars or registries, or could that be one kind of questionnaire? I would suggest as well having a look at the best practices paper, as that might also be part of the question that, you know, goes out to registrars or registries to see whether what was in that best practices paper in relation to locking, whether that could serve as any, you know, basis from which this working group could continue its discussions. We've spoken about requesting input from third parties, you know, such as UDRP providers, also looking at internal tracking stats they might have. The working group still might need to discuss, you know, what kind of mechanism we want to use for that. You know, do we look at sending them as well a questionnaire or a survey, or, you know, are we going to set up some specific discussions with them, either, you know, as part of one of our meetings or possibly at the Prague meeting? Then I think everyone, there was agreement as well to have a call for public comments that we just got out to the broader public. To request for input. And I think, again, there, you know, we might want to discuss a little bit in further detail whether that's going to be just a general call for public comments, or whether, you know, at this stage we already want to add in some more specific questions or specific items that we would look for public comment on. Then also the request for stakeholder group and constituency statements. I think there the working group will need to discuss a bit more whether, you know, again, that goes in the form of specific questions. I think we already agreed that for the registrar and the registry stakeholder group, that would be the case. The question is then, should there be as well for the other communities, for the other constituencies, is there a need to ask specific questions or you know, do we just ask them for input or provide them, for example, as well, you know, highlight that the public comment forum is open, that they're requested as well to put their comments in there. And then still, if, you know, people have further views on whether other ICANN ACs and SOs should be approached, you know, have people can think about that and you know, come back to that later. I think as a general note, what we've done in other working groups is basically send a note out to the different ACs and SOs and just highlight to them that this work has started, and if they have an interest in either participating or providing input, you know, they're encouraged to do so, and you know, from a staff perspective, we don't follow up if there is indeed an interest in further dialogue and participation. So if we then maybe start looking at the charter questions, and again, the idea here is not to, answer the charter questions necessarily, but maybe start looking at, what kind of approach we would need to take to try to, address the different charter questions. So if we maybe can start with the first charter question, which is whether the creation of an outline of a proposed procedure which a complainant must follow in order for a registrar to place a domain name on register lock would be desirable. So the question is there, what does the working group think? Is there any additional information that's required to answer this question? Is it just, discussions or polling the working group whether this would be a desirable approach? Are there any views on that? No comments? Matt, please go ahead.
Hey, just a quick comment. Maybe it makes sense to divide up the questions that we send out to like the registrar groups for input into two batches. The first group for sort of background information about what current practices are, and then the second group sort of tracking the sorts of issues raised in the charter questions as to what their preferences are going forward. That may give us sort of two different types of data that might be useful to guide our working group and discussion going forward.
Thanks, Matt. I think it's a very useful suggestion. I've noted that up in the request for public input part. So Laurie's hand go up and down again. Laurie, please go ahead. Laurie, I think you might be on mute.
Sorry,
we can't. yes,
sorry,
we're hearing
that.
You.
I was just going to say, I think that an outline would be beneficial for complainants because they often are unaware of what's necessary for a registrar to place a domain name on or a domain name on a lock. So if we were to provide an outline for complainants, then they would be clear about what we need as registrars in order to place the lock on the domain name.
Any further comments or questions on number one? If I can maybe ask people to mute their lines, we're getting a bit of background noise and echo. So charter question two asks whether the creation of an island of the steps of the process that a registrar can reasonably expect to take during a UDRP dispute would be desirable. And I guess this is probably one of the questions, as I refer to, that would be helpful to ask this specifically to registrars. Laurie, do you still have your hand up?
No, that's an old hand, sorry.
Oh, okay. Any other comments or suggestions? And move on to the question three, whether the time frame at which a registrar must lock a domain name after a UDRP has been filed should be standardized. And there's already one possible subtopic that has been suggested by David earlier. And are there any other possible subtopics or any, what would be required to determine indeed what that appropriate time frame might be? Any ideas, suggestions?
Just to note again that I think the time frame that had been contemplated in that earlier draft best practices outline was 48 hours. And I think it was calculated in that context from the receipt of the provider verification request, but I would imagine that we could also discuss having it run from the receipt of notice of the filing of a complaint by the complainant pursuant to charter item number one.
Noted that down. I mean, again, if there are any specific items people want to add here, I'm trying to take notes and look at the Adobe Connect at the same time. So if I'm missing anything, feel free to either type it in the chat or send me an email afterwards. This document will also be circulated to the mailing list, so everyone will have an opportunity to provide input and add suggestions as we move forward. So I may be looking at item or question number 4A. Whether what constitutes a locked domain domain name should be defined. Anything that the working group should specifically consider in that context? Or 4B, which is closely linked to whether once a domain name is locked pursuant to a UDRP proceeding, the registrant information for the domain name may be changed or modified.
Just one general point that might come up there is if the answer to that charter question is yes, whether there should be, and then what these would be, whether there should be some form of exception to enable updating of certain aspects of the registrant data, for example, contact information or billing information or something of this nature. I hesitate to raise it, but I will do it anyway, which is also the question of how the lock definition would then relate where you would have a privacy or a proxy registration service. And there would be a modification in the WHOIS data consequent to the filing of a UDRP proceeding in that situation. These might be two issues that we could also think a bit further about.
Thanks. Another as well, a question from Laurie. I think that relates to the definition here, which is whether DNS would be affected by the lock. Any other items that people think we should be adding here? I mean, people have an opportunity to add more items, and I'm sure as we start discussing other ideas, what will come up so we can build on this. It's just a starting framework. And then there's the last question, whether additional safeguards should be created for the protection of registrants in cases where the domain name is locked subject to UDRP proceedings.
I just have one more suggestion in connection with Charter Item 4B, which would be in the event that there would be a process for registrant information change or modification, what, if any, notification obligations should apply, for example, to the changing registrar in respect of UDRP proceedings, providers and parties thereto. That is to say, advising them that a change has occurred, that would then enable the provider, for example, to go back to the parties and advise them in the event that any modification to the filed pleadings would arise from that change.
I hope that I noted that down correctly, and if not, please let me know. I saw as well someone, I think, in the chat making another suggestion. I see Matt saying, we should also maybe consider whether the definition should expressly allow for an exception for privacy-related changes. I think that relates partly to the the exceptions. So
I think that's a good suggestion.
This is Matt. And just to clarify, we can also consider whether, kind of like whether there should be a timeline for there to be a lock put in place and what that timeline should be. Maybe we simply consider whether there should also be a timeline by which any substitutions on the privacy or proxy front need to be made by, in order for sort of the sort of stability concern that WIPO raised.
And I think that question maybe ties back in a little bit as well to the issue under 3.773 in the registration agreement, which calls for so-called disclosure within a reasonable period of time, because I think it is useful to be thinking about limiting that time frame. Perhaps in the same way that we would limit the duration in which the registrar would then be obliged to put on the lock. So, for example, a 48-hour period after which the relevant information in the whois is deemed to be correct for purposes of the UDRP proceeding or something of this nature.
And sorry, David, did I capture right that you're talking about limiting the time frame for disclosure of information?
Limiting the time frame in which any disclosure of information could occur.
I see people chatting rapidly, but if people want to speak about the issues they're raising as well, because I'm having difficulty keeping up with what people typing in the chat. I think... Laurie, are there any other items that should be added based on what you're putting in the chat, or is it just agreeing with what has already been put up on the screen?
I was going to say that, in our case, if we receive a verification request and the domain name has privacy, it's built into domains by proxies in terms of service that if there's a dispute over the domain name, that the privacy is canceled. Then when we receive the verification request, we notify domains by proxy. They cancel the privacy, and then we verify that the registrant is who the registrant is, not domains by proxy. Although we do receive UDRP complaints where domains by proxy is named, but then we always follow up and say, domains by proxy is not the registrant, it's privacy service, and then verify the actual registrant. It works really well so far. since I've been doing disputes since 2006, and it's always been that way. So it's worked out pretty well.
From our perspective at WIPO, it's also a system that I think, insofar as our communications with Laurie and co have been concerned, have been really workable. I am conscious that it can be sometimes a bit irritating for UDRP complainants to then receive from WIPO the notification that we would then send on to the complainant, indicating to them that there has been a modification and disclosure of the underlying registrants. But typically, the required amendments to the complaint is very brief, and it's a system I think that for the most part works well. It's not always the case, of course, that all registrars that offer these services are as prompt. And so perhaps it can be useful to think about fixing the timeline in a way that is a bit clearer so everybody is able to aspire to the same sorts of turnaround time.
Right. If it's made clear up front, before the complainants are filing the complaints, then, they could approach the privacy providers and, maybe get disclosure before they even file the complaint.
And this is Marika. I just took note as well of a comment that Luke made in relation to item 3, and I don't know if Luke is able to maybe provide a little bit of more background to it. It basically says if a registrar has to log the domain upon filing and before the provider review, the complaint is for administrative compliance, then should be hold harmless from complaining to the benefit of a registrar shall be given. Luke, is there anything further you want to explain about that?
Yeah, we've faced several cases where we've been informed of the filing of a complaint, but afterwards the complaint was rejected for compliance issue by the provider, and complainant did not go further. So basically, if we would have locked the domain, we would have bereaved our customers from his right on the domain for nothing.
Right, so I guess it's actually probably an item that might fall under item 5 as well as additional safeguards.
Yes, indeed.
Right. Well, maybe let's put that there. Victoria?
Yes, I wonder, this may or may not be the appropriate time, and it also may not, it may be a tangent, but I was wondering if it was possible. I mean, I don't have enough background, I haven't read anything on the subject, but could someone talk to the justification for lifting the privacy shield in the situation?
Yeah, the registrar accreditation agreement, and one of the things going forward is, you know, we have to look at how this interfaces with other requirements. Sometimes when we look at, you know, one policy in isolation from others, you end up with contradictions. For example, there is always a registrant obligation to have correct contact information. So, you know, if at the filing of a dispute they find, oh, well, you know, we moved our office 5 months ago and haven't updated our whois yet, you know, you have an affirmative obligation to have correct whois information. You know, by one policy and then another policy saying, oh, well, you can't change the WHOIS information. So where the privacy lift comes in is in the Registrar Accreditation Agreement, Section 3.7.7.3, which more or less has understood to govern legal disputes arising in connection with a domain that is held either in trust or on behalf of another party, and the obligation to disclose the identity of that party in order to avoid liability in the event of a legal dispute of some kind. So the general notion of lifting the WHOIS privacy has flowed from there, you know, as well as, you know, identification of serial bad faith actors. It really doesn't do the world any good to see, you know, 500 disputes against XYZ privacy service, you know, without some indication of who that party is, and that, for example, has significance relative to the new GTLD application process, where a TLD applicant can be disqualified upon having three adverse UDRP decisions within a certain time frame. Now, granted, GoDaddy, for example, is associated or allied with a very popular WHOIS privacy service, but, you know, holding GoDaddy, you know, responsible as it impacts, for example, the new TLD policy for domains that were in fact registered for the benefit of someone else is unfairly penalizing an innocent party.
Oh, thank you for that.
Was this John? John, if you can please just remind everyone to state your names before you start speaking, because that will really help getting the transcript right for those not on the call and reviewing it afterwards. So we just can, you know, assign the right quotes to everyone. Victoria, did you want to respond?
Just quickly, I just like to, so if I understand from that very that excellent explanation, the default rule is that the privacy is already listed automatically on the at some stage on the filing of a complaint. There's no real inroad into that. There's no exception. So there's no question about this. This is standard practice. This happens already. There are no issues around it. Except as it interacts with the timing of this policy or something. Would that be fair?
Provided that the privacy service is, in fact, you know, a bona fide privacy service. And this process also has the side effect of flushing out what are and what are not bona fide privacy services. I mean, there are cyber squatters who simply say, you know, it's registered to XYZ privacy service. And they never change it or update it when a dispute is filed, or they, you know, change it and update it to identify some fictitious party. But for those privacy services which are associated with a registrar and thus are under RAA 3.7.73, that is their typical protocol.
Okay, but if you didn't use a registrar privacy service, could you use? Are there people that use some other? I'm sorry to be ignorant here. Are there situations where the non-registry services where 3.7.73 doesn't apply and privacy shields don't come off? No.
Well, it gets into an odd question about what that paragraph means, and unfortunately, that paragraph is one that if you look at it too long and too closely, it does tend to lose meaning. But for example, anyone can be a privacy service. I'm an attorney. I sometimes hold domain names under, you know, the registrant John Berryhill Attorney Trust on behalf of, you know, clients who may be engaging in a domain transaction, but don't want either want the domain held by a third party or for information security reasons, don't want to have domain names be used for corporate intelligence to determine, you know, what their plans are, whether or not a company is planning on buying a piece of land to build a hotel somewhere. So, you know, in those instances, you know, the way that the RAA seems to read is that one can avoid liability if one, you know, produces a living, breathing registrant as opposed to a proxy party. Now, it's kind of unusual in that, well, you know, quite frankly, this is an ICANN contract that really can't assign civil liability to any other party. But as far as its interaction with other ICANN policies goes, it's up to the privacy service what they consider to be the standard for revealing the registrant information. And there is a parallel working group that I believe, well, actually there's a parallel study being done by the ICANN Compliance Department now and during the next few months on just what the standard practices are with who is privacy services. So some of what we're doing, if we're going to get into the who is privacy reveal, will be informed by a study that the compliance department is intending to complete over the next couple of months.
Matt, go ahead.
Short addendum to our very first item on this list. We may want to specifically ask registrars if they're providing privacy services, to speak specifically to sort of their current practices for swapping out registrant information in the case of a UDRP or other dispute as well.
Yeah, and just one other thing. The substantive impact on the policy is typically somewhat tangential. I mean, in a cyber squatting situation of the type for which the UDRP was designed, you know, the identity of the registrant is not always of tremendous importance unless they are, for example, a serial cyber squatter, that could be a useful information. But, you know, typically you have, you know, a trademark being abused by a third party, and who is doing that abuse is not of, you know, critical substantive importance. So where David had mentioned inviting complainants to amend the complaint, there is some differences among the dispute resolution providers in how they do that. But, you know, if your trademark's being abused, it really doesn't matter whether it's, you know, John Smith or Jane, you know, Jane Doe who is doing the abuse. The only minor other impact is in the selection of the UDRP mutual jurisdiction. If, for example, the complainant had chosen the jurisdiction of the privacy service purported location, and the registrant turns up in some other location, then there's some question as to what the mutual jurisdiction would be. But, I mean, that kind of comes down to, you know, the complainant having made a choice that might be subject to some change in information. But, you know, it is something of a nuisance to complainants when that happens if they are told by a provider, oh, in order for the case to proceed, you must amend your papers because, you know, you've got practitioners who have, you know, probably already billed the client being asked to perform some nuisance task with no substantive impact. You know, the policy assumes that the panelists have a certain degree of intelligence and knowledge of, you know, how the overall domain registration process works. And, you know, whether or not a panelist wants to take into account, you know, events that occurred with respect to Whois changes after the complaint was filed, most panelists are able to deal with that in a rational and intelligent manner.
Thanks, John, for the explanation. And we're actually running at the end of this call, so I would just like to encourage everyone to, you know, think further about, you know, the different questions that will need to be asked or any further information that will need to be obtained. I'll circulate this document to the list so people have a chance to review it and then send additional suggestions. And I would suggest that we continue our deliberations and at the during next week's call. The other item still outstanding as well, election of working group leadership. So, you know, please think about, you know, whether you'll be interested in chairing or serving as a co-chair. That will be much appreciated. So if there are no further pressing issues at this stage, I would just thank you all for joining, and I'll speak to you, all of you, next week, same time, 1400 UTC.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.